the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast.
Hey guys, appreciate y'all tuning back in to the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast. This is Bobby Golden. We have Jason Bond in the studio like always. And today we have our first guest, and we're going to bring on Dr. Nathan Slayton from the University of Arkansas, who...
He's not technically the first guest. He's just the first one that doesn't work for Mississippi State.
Well, he is the first out-of-state guest that's calling in on our new phone line system. So, Nate, you have been the soil testing director at Fayetteville for a while now. Kind of give us a rundown of your background, how you got to where you are right now.
Well, I came to Arkansas in 1986 for my master's degree, and got that and started work in southeast Arkansas as a county extension agent, and then moved to running the rice research verification program out of the rice research station at Stuttgart for about 5 years. Came back, got my PhD, and returned to Stuttgart as a state rice agronomist, and then I've been in Fayetteville for the past 19 years running the soil testing program and doing soil fertility research.
And you just took a big step last week, if I'm not correct.
Yes. As a matter of fact, just starting Monday, I am now the assistant director for the Agricultural Experiment Station. Still working with the soil testing and agriculture diagnostic labs. In that same capacity, but we'll be phasing out or, you know, turning over my research, hopefully, to others.
Well, good deal. And for those of y'all at home that don't know, I spent a lot of years with Nathan, and he helped make me who I am, so I appreciate him coming on today.
Yeah,
and
congratulations on the new job, too, man. That's awesome.
And for for those of you at home listening, if you didn't hear that, you can start at the bottom and make it all the way to the top. Nathan's living proof.
Now, before y'all get into some kind of fertility discussion, which I know is inevitable at this point when y'all get together, but Nathan, I want to rewind the clock. It's June the 27th, and it's about 9:30 p.m., and it's the bottom of the ninth with two outs. The ball hits the ground. What does Nathan Slayton think at that point? Because I know you're a huge baseball fan, so let's hear it. What was the first thing in your mind when the ball hit the ground at the College World Series?
I was thinking extra innings and that I probably wasn't going to make it past the 10th inning before I went to sleep.
Okay, fair enough. Was there a more Arkansas way for that play to play out?
It would have been nice had they made the catch, but it would have been a tough play.
Yeah, I agree.
But, again, Jason's only asking those questions, guys, because he was living and dying when that catch popped up.
I absolutely was. Broke my heart, man.
All right. Well, that's, I think, a good intro. Again, we appreciate Nathan coming home. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, Nate, and why I wanted you to have on here today, I think I want to cover two topics. One is tissue testing, and the other is potash deficiency, how we've been seeing it creep up over the years in many of our crops. So, you know, out there in the world today, there's a lot of tissue testing going on. I think tissue tests are great things if used properly. Can you talk a little bit about how you approach tissue testing and how to interpret those values?
Sure. I agree with, you know, what you said. Tissue testing is a great tool for growers and consultants to use. But, you know, it's just like every other tool that's in your toolbox. You know, it one tool doesn't necessarily, you know, fit everything you need to do. So we have to be careful about how we use it. And, you know, it again, can be a great asset, or, you know, it can cost our growers money if it's used inappropriately. And, you know, one of the things that a lot of people don't understand is that even though, you know, there are typically textbook values that supposedly define when a nutrient is sufficient or deficient, not all of those what we would call critical concentrations or research-based. And, you know, typically most plants, the textbooks only include one concentration, and that's
at a specific point in time, right? One concentration at a specific point in time. And a lot of those, the research, the ones that are research-based, in my opinion, if you get to digging behind it, come out of a greenhouse and not necessarily out of the field.
That's true for some. Some of those are, you know, for the macronutrients, where, you know, what are the most typical nutrient deficiencies you see, you know, in Mississippi, Arkansas, other states. You know, typically those nutrients are research-based, and the numbers are pretty good. But again, like you said, it may be for just one point in time. And, you know, we know just like kids, you know, plants grow over time and their nutritional needs change. So the critical concentration for soybean, as an example, is different at R2 stage than it is at R4. So that one critical concentration doesn't apply to all times.
And you've been doing a lot of research trying to determine those differences, especially in soybean. Across those different growth stages, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's going to be different depending on what time and actually what plant part you might be sampling.
That's correct. So, you know, the thing when somebody goes out in the field, they have to first make note of the crop growth stage so that, you know, we can kind of gauge what those critical concentrations may be doing, you know, if it's beyond that one critical or growth stage where it's defined for. And then you also have to know what plant part needs to be sampled. So there is some knowledge, you know, you just can't go out in the field and grab a plant and send it in and get the information you need.
Well, what about, so if we're doing a tissue test, Nate, are we talking about a scheduled, you know, like part of a consulting program, or is this in response to something? And then, you know, depending on what you say, I got another question related to that. So tell me what you think about that, and then I'll follow up.
Well, there's really two ways to use tissue analysis. One would be as a troubleshooting, you know, regardless of what growth stage it is, if the plant's sick, you know, we need to take, you know, tissue from both healthy appearing plants and the plants that don't look good. And again, it really doesn't matter what growth stage it is, but, you know, we're trying to do comparative analysis there. So that's troubleshooting. Now, the second way would be more of a crop monitoring program. And those types of plant samples, you know, depending upon the nutrient and the information that's available, may be taken at key growth stages. Which, you know, there may be only one or two select growth stages to monitor. Or if you remember the old cotton petiole monitoring program, where, you know, at a certain growth stage, you know, you basically collected plant samples on a weekly basis to monitor what that plant was doing based upon the growing conditions, the yield potential, all those things kind of rolled into one.
Okay, in that second case where you're basically, you know, scheduling a tissue sample, for lack of a better word, how does stress work into that? So, you know, something maybe even like drought stress, you know, we're about to start irrigating, but we haven't yet, you know, should we wait till after an irrigation, you know, that type of thing. And then of course, you know, it could go into herbicide stress or other pest pressure, things like that too.
Yeah. So that's really difficult, to answer, Jason, just because, you know, we can sit around and argue about, you know, what effect that stress or alleviating that stress has on both nutrient uptake and yield potential.
Well, is it accurate? I mean, would you get your bang for your buck with a tissue test if you show up to the field to pull the test and you know you're dealing with an extra stress?
Certainly, I think something like drought could very well, you know, the information could still be very useful. There's other instances out there that I think, you know, the information might be severely compromised. For example, you know, if you have some type of herbicide drift where you have severe stunting, the nutrient uptake may still be occurring in the plant. It's just, you know, the above ground growth is stunted. So, you know, that plant may actually have nutrient accumulation or high nutrient concentrations in it because it's not adding biomass or dry matter across time.
All right, Nate. So you talked about hyperaccumulating a nutrient there. You know, when we get a lot of tissue test in, oftentimes if a cation is lacking, we'll see another cation very high. Can you talk about that in relation to a lot of the potash tissue testing that we've been doing?
Yeah, you know, there's several things that, you know, you kind of notice in tissue analysis, you know, after you've done it for 20 or 25 years, and especially with rice, potash deficiency, you almost don't even need the percent potassium because you can look at the sodium concentration in the plant and pretty well tell that, you know, the plant is K deficient because K deficient rice accumulates sodium. Now in other plants such as soybean, we don't necessarily see that, but certainly, you know, you can look at other nutrients a lot of times, and the nutrients that are not limiting may be higher than normal because, again, they are present in adequate concentrations and are being actively taken up, whereas, you know, the one nutrient that's deficient is limiting dry matter accumulation by that plant, and it'll still be low.
All right, Nate. So, you know, one of my biggest questions I get day in, day out basis on the phone about tissue testing, especially when we're doing the monitoring type programs, is say my plant is low in potassium, but I see no visual symptomology of potassium. Do I make an application? Do I wait to see visual symptomology? Or does that grow, how does growth stage play into that?
Well, yeah, it just happens, and the comments I'll make here on potassium are because, you know, there's a lot of research, including my own program, that has gone into potassium. But the same may not apply for other micronutrients where there's simply the occurrence of those nutrient deficiencies are rare. You know, information on truly what the critical concentration is may be lacking, as well as whether or not the plant will respond to that nutrient, you know, at a range of growth stages. But for potassium, you know, if you know the growth stage, what we have seen here in Arkansas is that you can find potassium response to K applications, and this is what we have not focused on foliar, but we focused on granular potash all the way up to R5 stage. The surprising thing about soybean that we have seen, when you have yield potentials of, say, 70 bushel, you may not see any visual symptoms of potassium deficiency, but you could still be losing, say, 10 bushel to the acre yield potential from that term that everybody heard in soil fertility called hidden hunger. And a lot of times, you know, those plants don't necessarily show symptoms until right before maturity, when it's obviously too late.
Yeah, I think we have a lot of that going on in Mississippi, especially on our lighter textured ground. So, you know, one thing that I would add to that is the research we have here in Mississippi suggests that we can get yield responses on soybeans up to R3 because we didn't take samples at R4 and R5. So, you know, we've got a very similar data set, I think, that says you can get a response to a granular application a lot later in the season than a lot of people out there realize, because, you know, the one thing in the world that I hear is, well, if I fly that potash on, that plant's not going to take it up because I didn't put it out in November or February, you know.
Yes. So, You know, the one thing, you know, if you've got potassium deficiency symptoms showing up in fields, you know, prior to, say, R3 stage, you're probably looking at a much greater yield loss than, you know, what we've talked about. And some of our trials, again, where we've had 70-plus bushel yield potential, it's not uncommon to see yield responses of 20 and 25 bushel of the acre for plants that started showing K deficiency during late vegetative growth and, you know, has continued on. So when those plants are showing deficiency symptoms, you know, they're truly really hurting for nutrients. And, you know, the more severe that nutrient deficiency is, the more critical it is to get those nutrients out as soon as possible. Because what our curve shows in those highly responsive situations is once, you know, these group four soybeans go beyond, you know, R2 stage, you know, 25 days after bloom or so, the yield response to potassium fertilization does start to fall off. But, you know, again, you will still see a positive effect all the way up to R5.
So earlier is always better, but there are avenues to make salvage applications is what I hear you saying.
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, what we would like to, the situation that we would like to have for all nutrients, but certainly it's been the mindset for nitrogen because of all the loss mechanisms is, you know, we want a soil test to predict, you know, what we need, but then we want some type of in-season method to evaluate the sufficiency of that plant and how effectively, you know, the plant has taken up the fertilizer or the soil nutrients that are available. And I think with potassium now, especially for soybean, we have that information. You know, we're just trying to wrap up some of that research this summer, and then it'll be available.
Well, pulling the tissue test aspect back into it, Nate, we're talking about potassium, but what other nutrients, whether macro or micronutrients, can we get a plant response to, maybe a corrective response to, based on the results of a tissue test? I always get questions when we have some level of herbicide injury, whether it be from the application to the field or from off target movement. You know, hey, is there something I can use to pull this plant out? And usually there's not, you know, in my arena, but based on, you know, just, you know, herbicide injury aside, when you have some low readings on a tissue test, which nutrients do, you know, we're talking about soybeans, so just stay on that crop. Which nutrients will soybean respond to when they're low, you know, during the season?
Well, again, that's, you know, that's a real simple question, but it doesn't have a real clear answer for, you know, many of the mineral nutrients. You know, for a lot of the micronutrients, which I think are the ones that tend to get keyed on from these in-season, you know, tissue analyses that are being performed. You know, if we just fall back to boron, you know, boron deficiency, what we've seen here in Arkansas, it's, you know, the odds of getting the plant turned around when you see true boron deficiency symptoms, it's a crapshoot. Sometimes it responds with fertilizer. Sometimes it responds when you don't apply fertilizer. And sometimes, you know, there's just seems like there's a point of no return where it doesn't matter, you know, what you do. You know, when you see the deficiency symptoms, that's what you've got for the rest of the season. For many of the other micronutrients, such as copper, you know, the chances of getting that plant to respond are really unknown because the research that would support salvage type applications and yield, you know, documented yield responses just isn't there.
Yeah, and I, you know, you specifically mentioned copper. I bet I've had 5 phone calls this week specifically to our broadleaf crops, you know, soybean and cotton, saying, hey, my tissue test says I have a copper deficiency. And my first question is, okay, where are those magical levels to say copper deficient coming from? You know?
Yeah, you know, two classic examples that I've seen here in Arkansas is one, we can just focus on one crop, but winter wheat, if you take samples during that early or mid-tillering stage, you know, where you've got relatively rapid plant growth after those, after you first apply that, say, February, almost every tissue analysis I've seen of wheat in Arkansas shows, according to the textbook value, that it's deficient in zinc and boron. But the research that we've conducted shows that, you know, it doesn't respond to zinc and boron, and that's a classic case of that textbook value that's being used to make that diagnosis is simply not very accurate.
Right, and, you know, that's kind of what I've told people is, okay, we're doing a lot of this monitoring testing rather than diagnostic testing, and, okay, a piece of paper tells us our plant's low, but I'm seeing a good, healthy plant in the field. At that point, you walk away and maybe take that test again in subsequent weeks, but don't trigger an application at that point. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, the one thing that I would certainly encourage is, you know, for those guys that are getting those types of recommendations, you know, that research is fairly easy to provide some answers, you know, so talk to your extension and research folks, and it's something that, you know, if low copper is common in soybean or whatever crop, you know, some relatively simple trials can be designed to determine whether or not the plant responds to copper at that time. So talk to your research and extension people if you're getting those types of recommendations and diagnosis, and encourage your commodity boards to fund that research.
One I'd like to hear, you know, either one or both of y'all talk about is zinc. You know, one of the first field calls I went on years ago in Mississippi was a zinc deficiency on corn. I didn't know what it was, and the guy that called me thought it was Command. That's why he called me, and it wasn't Command, and I didn't know at the time what it was. We eventually figured it out. But then since then, you know, that's some years that's been real common in our corn, and, you know, the question is, you know, bleaching herbicides. But then, too, seen it in rice, and, you know, without Bobby being in the field, I would have never, you know, stumbled upon the fact that was zinc-deficient rice. So I would be interested in just hearing y'all kind of compare notes on what you see with zinc deficiency, because I know that's a big deal for us in some years.
Yeah, so, you know, herbicides, you know, when you start, you know, mixing, especially those that are bleachers with some of the different nutrient deficiency symptoms, boy, it can make it really difficult for, you know, even somebody that's dealt with that nutrient and diagnosed that nutrient deficiency, you know, 100 or more times in the field. So, you know, there's other symptoms, you know, like zinc a lot of times causes the stacking of or lack of separation of the internodes. So, you know, you see kind of the leaves stacked up in rice, you know, you tend to get some bronzing, which is, you know, really just kind of like a fever because there's multiple things that can cause it. But, you know, a lot of times what we encourage, you know, our consultants and county extension agents to do, you know the classic symptom, you know the secondary type symptoms of those nutrient deficiencies or toxicities, but you've always got tissue analysis to kind of fall back on. But you also have to realize that, you know, sometimes when those plants have been out in the field and been deficient for a couple of weeks, that, you know, even the tissue analysis may come back kind of screwy.
Yeah, we see that a lot over here, and a lot of the times, you know, when someone calls and said, hey, I'm sending you some bad plants, we never get the good plants with it. And then we end up going to the field looking, pulling our own set of plants to confirm. But we've had really good luck with diagnosing zinc deficiency in corn over here and helping a lot of guys out. Through a lot of our research, and it's shocking, but we've had yield responses up to 20 bushels when we were zinc deficient in areas. And so you can do a lot with zinc. For sure.
Well, I think we've had good education on differentiating the symptoms between, you know, herbicide response to some of those bleaching herbicides and the zinc deficiency symptom.
So, Nate, one of the things that we have a big issue with over here, and I know I've talked to you a lot about it, and that is manganese deficiency in soybean. And most of the time that's occurring on our heavier soils that may have been rotated with rice in the past, but over the last 6 to 7 years, it's been in a monoculture soybean system. Are y'all seeing any of that across the river?
I don't know that we have, you know, a large percentage of our acreage in that monoculture, but certainly we see manganese deficiency in soybeans in kind of two different situations. One of them is just like you have in Mississippi. A lot of these heavy clay soils have very low manganese availability. And a lot of times you can pick that up on your soil tests. It's just, you know, we don't have real well-defined levels. But just being alert to the fact that a lot of these, you know, heavy clay soils do tend to have lower than average extractable manganese is certainly a, you know, a red flag. Especially, you know, manganese is a micronutrient, and a lot of times when you have adverse conditions, you know, cool, wet soils, or sometimes just wet soils, or, you know, the opposite extreme, dry soils, you know, both of those situations can limit our crops, that nutrient deficiency expressed more severely. So the other situation that we see is our, you know, really sandy textured soils. And a lot of times, you know, there's just kind of veins that run through the field where that occurs. But certainly, you know, you can see manganese. A lot of times the veins on the leaves initially remain green. Eventually, you know, they may bleach out, but the leaf will lose its color, but the veins remain green. And I don't know that there's been a whole lot of research done in the Mid-South. The first research that was done on it was in North Carolina, and I think, you know, some of the observations was, you know, you just almost had to keep spraying early season to try to get the symptoms to go away.
You know, and I think that's the same thing we've seen over here when we've threw a lot of foliars at it, and we can clear up symptomology. And we've applied granulars and can clear up symptomology, but we can't necessarily fix the problem with what we've been trying to do right now. All right, well, we'll end this thing up, and I appreciate everybody listening. This has been the longest podcast that we've done, but we've felt like it was warranted having a special guest from another state come on.
VIP.
VIP. Definitely VIP now. What number are you in command, like third? Fourth?
I really haven't thought of that in that regard. So I still just consider myself working for the agriculture community.
Well, hey, I appreciate you teaching me everything you know. Like I said earlier, I wouldn't be in this role or sitting here without all your leadership and guidance you give me through the years, and I appreciate that.
I absorbed some too, Nate, even though I was down the hall.
Well, I know certainly I appreciate you guys having me on, and I hear lots of positive comments from all over the Mid-South about the job you guys are doing over there, so keep up the good work.
Well, thank you.
We sure appreciate you. And, hey, just because you're wearing a suit and tie now don't mean you can't come on the podcast. And if you ever get back down here, we still got to go to Doe's.
Sounds like a good invitation. I'll try to put it in my schedule somewhere.
All right. Thank you for coming on, Nate, and call us soon.
The Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast is produced by the Mississippi State University Extension Service.